Hello, welcome to this episode of Kennedy's Medical Law Matters podcast, where we dive into some of the most important conversations around healthcare and medical law. I'm Rob Tobin, and I'm a partner here at Kennedy's and head of the medical law group. Today, we'll be exploring eating disorders and the challenges that arise around treatment and the legal frameworks that might need to be used to treat people, sometimes against their will. I have the pleasure of speaking today with Dr. Anna Conway Morris, a consultant psychiatrist at Cambridgeshire and Peterborough NHS Foundation Trust. Anna is a specialist in eating disorders, and I'll let Anna tell us more about her background and experience shortly. Please be aware that this episode discusses sensitive topics around eating disorders and their treatments, mental health issues, capacity and consent, and the treatment of children, which some listeners might find distressing. Before we start, make sure you subscribe to our Medical Law Matters e-newsletter for updates on upcoming episodes and special content. You can find all links in the show notes. And don't forget to follow this podcast on your favorite podcast platform, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, or wherever you're listening to today, so you never miss an episode. Now, before we start, Anna, perhaps you could quickly introduce yourself properly.
Thank you, Rob. I'm delighted to be here. I'm Anna Conway Morris. I'm a consultant psychiatrist in CPFT. As Rob has just said, I originally trained as a child psychiatrist, but now work in adult services, having worked for some time in children's eating disorder services. I'm also the head of school, which is a medical education post where I'm responsible for resident doctors in the east of England for their postgraduate training in psychiatry. But I do have a special interest in eating disorders, and in particular in complex cases that may involve the Mental Health Act or the Mental Capacity Act, which we are dealing with often in our practice now. I work in the community, but we manage transitions to inpatients as well, into psychiatric hospitals, but also treating patients in general hospitals, in what we call acute hospitals.
Thank you. So welcome. And I know you mentioned community treatment, and we'll talk about that later, because I know there's many innovations that you and your team are working on to prevent people having to spend too much time in hospitals. Perhaps we can start, though, if you don't mind, with a definition or an explanation of what we mean by eating disorders.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a complex field. Eating disorders are common, many people will know about anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa. There are other eating disorders around, like binge eating disorder, where people overeat rather than eat too little. In bulimia, people will binge eat and then purge by various means. These eating disorders cause a lot of misery in the general population. They often go unnoticed for quite a while, that people just feel there's something not right, but they're not quite aware that they have developed an eating disorder. And often people are very ashamed, because especially the binge eating component can evoke this sort of shame, guilty feeling. Patients with eating disorder are often very reluctant to seek help in general, because they feel that they should be able to manage this by themselves, or sometimes they feel that it's not a problem, and it's more of a sort of coping strategy in their lives. They often think that it's not much of an issue until it's very severe.
And is there a typical patient group that you see, or does it encompass all age ranges, genders? How do they manifest?
Yeah, so I mean, it can affect people at any age, I would say, but it is much more common in young people. So in Cambridge, in our service, we have a lot of students. So university students is a classic group of people, young people away from home in stressful situations. The peak age for, say, anorexia nervosa, which is the most sort of dangerous or often severe eating disorder, the peak onset is in the adolescent years, when the body changes naturally, and that can be unsettling for a group of youngsters. It's more common in women, but there are also cases in men, and you might be aware of some prominent men who have come out speaking about eating disorder. So they are also causing impairment and disability in men. It's not just a problem of women.
You mentioned students, and Cambridge is obviously a large student town. Does the fact that many of your patients are likely highly intelligent people, very articulate, make it harder for you to decide whether someone might lack mental capacity to make decisions around treatment for their eating disorder?
No, I mean, I think in general, the capacity issue, I mean, obviously being able to absorb information and weigh up the risks and benefits is a vital part of the capacity assessment to see whether a patient can do that. But I would say that in general, being intelligent or young does not necessarily mean that capacity is not impaired. I think the eating disorder has got subtle ways of impairing capacity, which can be quite difficult to detect. So partly the malnourishment that you get in anorexia nervosa can impair some of the brain function, some of the higher functions in your brain, your judgment, your memory, your concentration, things like that. And that can have an impact on capacity. But also, I think some people, especially the students we see now who have come through the pandemic and have spent more time at home and been more socially more isolated, I think for them, there is a bigger transition to coming to university and living independently than for some generations before. And I think some of them do actually lack some of the maturity and the skills that you need to make decisions about your health. So I would say in general, they're not protected from that. It just comes out in different ways.
I suppose just to explain to listeners, I know we've talked about capacity in other pods as well, but the mental capacity or the lack of capacity is where someone is unable to use and weigh information and communicate that decision in relation to something. Here we're talking about treatment for their eating disorder, but it could be about anything. So someone might, for example, be a brilliant student and be able to write an amazing essay or articulate some phenomenal point about their chosen specialist subject at university. But at the same time, and this is the crucial point, because of the manifestation of their, like we call it, disorder of the mind or brain, but in this case, an eating disorder, that in a sense, am I right, is sort of clouding their judgment around that particular topic. Is that a fair synopsis?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are different aspects to it that can cloud your judgment. I mentioned that some of the changes that go on in the brain when the brain is malnourished. But there are also some of the psychological components of eating disorder. For example, part of it is often this intense fear of gaining weight. So it's a fear of the treatment that then impairs your judgment to weigh up the risks and the benefits, so that often the treatment is perceived as much more dangerous and risky than it actually is, and the benefit of the treatment is often seen as negligible, or actually the treatment is often seen as counterproductive, and due to those psychological factors. And I think this fear can be really, really intense, and can impair your capacity to make decisions. I mean, for example, you know, I have had a young woman, you know, who told me a few months ago, saying, I'd rather die than gain weight, you know. And this is the sort of process that I'm talking about, this sort of intense fear, where you think, actually, you know, if I had to choose, I would choose death over having to do this treatment.
When we talk about treatment, then, this isn't a condition that can just be treated and cured. Hopefully it can be cured, but I'm not quite sure what that definition means. But certainly in the short term, there might be an acute treatment. If someone, for example, is seriously malnourished, in my experience, they might need an NG feed or some other means to help them take on nutrition. But presumably there's more long-term treatment as well, like therapies and other factors that you would encourage for them to take that you can't necessarily force on them. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. I mean, in general, in medicine, you don't want to force any treatment on any patient if you have a choice. And all successful treatments, you know, are delivered in collaboration with the patient. So that is always your plan A for anything that you do in medicine. With eating disorders, it is in some ways different from other mental illness, is that we know that medications are not usually effective in eating disorders. So the usual medications that we would use in psychiatry, such as antidepressants, antipsychotic medications, and so on, they have not shown any benefit in eating disorders. They are sometimes used to treat other co-occurring conditions like depressive illness or psychosis, but they don't have an impact on the sort of thoughts and feelings that you get with eating disorder, and they don't change your behavior. So in general, they are not used, and it's psychological treatments that are the mainstay and that are recommended in the national best practice guidelines. Now, of course, with psychological treatments, the patient has to be engaged with that, otherwise it doesn't work. And fostering that trust, building that relationship to make it possible for the patient to engage with the treatment is absolutely crucial. Now, what makes that difficult? Well, what I spoke about at the beginning is that patients are often reluctant to seek help, either because they don't think that there's anything wrong, or because they're ashamed, or they think that they can't really be helped. There's also, for some patients, every patient's slightly different, but for some patients, there is benefit from having the eating disorder. Like a friend in your life, something to hold on to. And some patients are very reluctant to give that up, even if they have already come to harm from the eating disorder. So the eating disorder can serve a function in your life that you don't want to give up. It is about building that trust with the patient to help them understand that there is a different way forward. People recover from eating disorders all the time, especially with the early intervention, which is there's now a big focus on intervening early. So assessing and treating eating disorders within the first month of presentation. And certainly people who get early treatment have much better outcomes. But despite early treatment, this can become a chronic disorder, which is then more difficult to treat. And likewise, as you've just mentioned, Rob, some patients present already very severely unwell to a point that their brain is starved that they can't practically engage in psychological treatments. And for them, of course, things are quite different and they may need an acute intervention, such as what you have mentioned, nasogastric feeding, rehydration, or other treatment in the general hospital.
Thank you. And I think that there is the nub of the issue, certainly from the legal perspective. And bearing in mind, when lawyers get involved in these cases, which thankfully is rare, it tends to be at the acute phase when it's very difficult to treat the person in another way. And I use the word force deliberately, slightly provocatively, because I also see, again, from a legal perspective, how very challenging it can be to, on the one hand, look at what you can do from a legal perspective, and perhaps I'll mention that in a second, but what you should do from a medical perspective, and that's very different. So there are various legal frameworks you can help treat a patient who has an eating disorder. One of those is under the Mental Health Act, and even under the Mental Health Act, whilst it is possible to treat someone against their will in certain circumstances, is Section 63, and it says that patients can be treated without consent for the mental disorder from which they're suffering. And with that, there's a Section 145, legal stuff here, Section 145(4), which provides that mental treatment under the Mental Health Act has to be for the purpose of which is to alleviate or prevent a worsening of the disorder or one or more of its symptoms or manifestations. And those two together make it quite challenging legally. On the one hand, what you can do, on the other hand, what you should do. So there are cases that I see where it is technically possible under the letter of the law to, for example, force someone, a patient, to have an NG, nasogastric feed, even if they don't want it. But on the other hand, a psychiatrist like you will say, well, actually, I'm the responsible clinician. I make the decision. And for me, I'm not prepared to do that because I don't think it's appropriate therapeutically, perhaps. So that's the challenges we face. And you must face that a million times greater because you have a therapeutic relationship with your patients that presumably can be harmed in a way if you start forcing treatment on them when they don't want to, even if technically you can.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there are different aspects to this. Of course, using the Mental Health Act, on a patient, you know, coercing them to have a treatment that they don't wish to have, which is the situation that you're in when you detain a patient for treatment, that always changes the relationship with the patient. And some patients will later on, you know, accept why you have done that. But some patients will choose not to deal with you ever again. And I think that can happen in any field of psychiatry. I think in what makes eating disorders different is that it's not just an illness of the mind or the brain. It also affects the body, and a lot of the problems that you get are actually physical health problems, such as, you know, cardiac arrhythmia, dehydration, the consequences of malnutrition on your bones, for example, you know, osteoporosis, skin disorders such as pressure sores or edema, which you get from malnutrition. And these are often the things that then need to be treated acutely, and there you enter a sphere that is quite different. So force feeding, for example, so, you know, and G feeding against the will for anorexia nervosa can be done under the Mental Health Act. Other physical treatments can't usually be delivered under the Mental Health Act like that. So it is always an unusual situation. The consequences of coercion in the long run is something that's always on our mind, because you're forcing someone into doing something or accepting something that they don't want. And that has long-reaching consequences, because that person feels controlled and coerced. They often develop symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder afterwards, and we see that commonly, and it also puts them off to accept treatment later on. Many patients then feel that it's harder to engage in voluntary treatment afterwards, once you have been coerced, because that whole relationship changes, and also your understanding of the team around you who are there to help you. But when you're being held down or restrained, you know, it doesn't feel like that. The practical aspects are also a consideration. People think, well, I can use the Mental Health Act and then I can make this happen and I can save your life. But actually, practically force feeding someone is extremely difficult. And in the acute hospital, often there are practical difficulties that make this really tricky. So, for example, in an underweight patient, just the act of restraint, you might think, well, if someone is weak and underweight, that might be easier to do. But actually, there are huge risks involved for the patient as well as the staff, from, for example, broken bones, hematomas, you know, bruises, and so on. And many patients come to harm from that process of restraint to feed. So these are all things that you need to take into account when you're thinking about using the Mental Health Act or forcing treatment.
And it really comes back to autonomy. So in all fields of medicine, as you said earlier, it's crucial that patient autonomy is at the forefront of all decision-making, and you should avoid, if at all possible, compelling a treatment on someone against their will, unless you absolutely have to provide it in their best interests, and of course, you're allowed to do so. Does it make it harder for you as the patient's carer to ensure they retain that complete autonomy when you don't believe they're making the right decision? I mean, now, as we know, people are perfectly entitled to make bad decisions, but that doesn't mean they lack capacity, of course. But when their mind is addled by an acute or chronic disorder in their brain, which is preventing them from understanding or using or weighing the information, that might mean that they lack capacity and can't make a decision, and that their autonomy will necessarily be compromised. For this patient, in all other aspects of their life, they might be able to live and function at a very high level, like writing that brilliant essay I mentioned earlier, but not in relation to treatment decisions for their eating disorder. And is this made even harder if, as I'm certainly seeing in many of the cases I'm involved in, the patient coincidentally or perhaps alongside has a neurodivergent characteristic such as autism? So how do you enable those patients to feel they've retained their autonomy whilst maintaining and enhancing that therapeutic relationship that is so crucial to achieve the positive outcomes you strive for?
Yes, it's always difficult to weigh those things up, the risks and benefits, and the benefits of being able to make your own decisions and to engage in treatment voluntarily are obviously huge. And because recovery from an eating disorder is a long process, it's very rare for people to recover within a few weeks. For most people, the recovery takes several years. And I think to keep that in mind and the process that's involved from the start is really important. But when you are in a crisis and you're worried that a patient might die, it's really difficult to keep that process and the long-term perspective in mind. And I think particularly with people with autism, there's a large overlap between particularly restrictive eating disorders such as anorexia nervosa and autistic spectrum disorder, and patients can be quite rigid and just lack that little bit of flexibility to think about a compromise, so to speak. So they often want a clear answer from you about what is going to happen. I think having to deal with this uncertainty, but if I don't do this, what will you then do? That sort of situation, and I think can be really difficult to manage, because of course it all depends. Well, no doctor goes into medicine to force people to have treatment, but also no doctor goes into medicine to watch people die. So, of course, you want to save a life, you want to heal people, but on the other hand, you want to take them along on this journey rather than have to make these decisions. How do we get around this? Well, we don't work in isolation, so we reach out to people, we speak to the relatives, we have our multidisciplinary teams where we discuss these things and we think about, can we make a compromise? Can we negotiate? Can we find a way around this situation? We work with our colleagues in the general hospital, and of course, we have advice from people like yourselves. How can we work within the legal frameworks? Personally, I always think it's always better to think about clinically what do you want to do, and then think about how can we make this happen within the law and with the guidelines that we operate in. But it is absolutely crucial to have an understanding of what you can do, because in the end, if you have a patient whose life is at risk and who cannot make decisions for themselves, it is your duty to do something. You cannot just stand by and let things play out and hope that they don't end badly.
Yeah, absolutely. And presumably there is almost a conflict sometimes between, I suppose, a patient who, again, might be incredibly intelligent, articulate, and doesn't believe or agree with your diagnosis or perhaps your prognosis that you're suggesting for them. For example, I know of some cases where the patient has said, I'm comfortable with a BMI of 11 or 12. And for you as a clinician, presumably, and also for the gastroenterologists and everyone else in the multidisciplinary team, and for their relatives, their loved ones, they don't think that's a safe BMI for anyone. And how do you deal with that, if I can call it a conflict, that disagreement of opinion, to make it safe for the patient, but also maintaining that therapeutic relationship?
So absolutely. I think what you've brought up is a classic sort of conversation that we have with patients. Because part of the eating disorder is that the body adapts to the low weight and to some extent compensates. So that many people, even if they're severely underweight, when they've been like this for a long time, they might not feel ill in any way. And patients often say this to us. They say, but I'm not ill. There's not a problem with me. I can walk upstairs. I can go to work. I can do anything that I want to do. Why are you trying to get me to accept treatment that I don't want? And the human body is remarkable. I mean, you will find patients who run for miles, even though they're severely underweight. And some of them, for example, have got completely normal blood tests, where you think, how is this possible? How can the human body function at that weight? But it doesn't mean that things can't change very quickly. All it needs is, let's say, an infection, a virus, a broken bone, or a stressful event. And things can very quickly decompensate and the person can collapse and even die. And I think it is communicating that risk. The eating disorder has a way of tricking you into thinking that there's nothing wrong and that to some extent, nothing bad will happen to you. It is this sort of denial that can go along with it. And it can be really powerful. And I think it is our job as doctors to look at the facts and remind ourselves, you know, and clearly communicate those risks to the patient, even in situations where it's difficult to do so. But it's really important that you don't get drawn into this way of thinking, which is what often happens to relatives, because they see this in front of their own eyes, they get used to the way the person looks, you know, they get used to this underweight person living with them, walking around, and they start to believe this as well. And I think as a doctor, it's really important to remind yourself that when you are doing this, when you're living at this low body mass index, that things can change very, very quickly and become dangerous very quickly and not play along with this risk taking.
Yeah, and you've mentioned relatives a few times, and I suppose particularly where we're talking about young patients, I'm assuming the involvement of parents, loved ones, carers is vitally important in the holistic treatment and care for some of these patients. How do you educate those carers to help their loved one go down the correct path for recovery and ensure they don't say or do the wrong thing, which might inadvertently cause them harm by, for example, saying the wrong thing, shaming them about their weight, say?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, for young people, one of the treatments for anorexia nervosa, which is actually the recommended first-line treatment, is a family-based therapy, and that involves the whole family, not just the young person, because we know that the family can play a powerful role in the recovery of the patient. The first thing always is to help people understand that they're not to blame. Eating disorders have many causes, and they can be triggered by really quite small events in a patient's life, and relatives are not to blame for the development of eating disorders. Parents are not to blame for the development of eating disorders in their children. And I think understanding that is really important because people often feel a sort of guilt and shame around the eating disorder. And absolutely, it is about showing people that some of the behaviors that they may be doing that maintain or sort of further the eating disorder. And these are things that are done unconsciously or unwittingly rather than deliberately. But again, they can challenge the treatment. So involving the family in the treatment and sort of helping them understand how they can help the young person is crucial. I do think that with the Mental Health Act, things can get very difficult because one of the parents is almost always in the role of the nearest relative. And of course, once you get into the place where the Mental Health Act has to be used to send a young person into psychiatric hospital, into a specialist eating disorder unit, for example, or to detain them in a general hospital for refeeding, things can get very difficult for the family. I've had young people who, for example, have looked up details and their rights under the Mental Health Act and have gone to their parents and say, I know that you can discharge me from this hospital as the nearest relative. Why are you not helping me? And I think this is an area that is really, really difficult. The role of the nearest relative under the current Mental Health Act for eating disorders is really problematic. And I think parents often find themselves in this role where they want to do the right thing for their child, but they also feel this horrible responsibility. Obviously, in those situations, as a doctor, you would never recommend that the nearest relative use their power of discharge because it would be totally irresponsible. But parents often feel intensely guilty about that.
Yeah, I should explain to the listeners, I mean, many listeners will know about the Mental Health Act, I'm sure, but just in case for those who don't. So where someone has been detained under the Mental Health Act, as you say, there are many powers that and rights that they have, and one of the crucial rights is through this the phrase the nearest relative, which is a legal term whereby, and there's a sort of a long list of people who can fulfill that role, and it's a sort of a hierarchy, and a parent would be quite high up on that list. And so what you're saying is there may well become a tension, a conflict between what the patient wants their parent to do for them, because the patient, perhaps they don't understand what's best for them at that particular moment in time, against what the, let's say, a parent would dearly love to do for their child because they just want to make them happy, against what they're being told by the doctors is the right thing to do, in this case, not discharging them, but keeping them detained in a hospital for their own safety. And that goes back to that therapeutic relationship. In this case, it's the relationship between child and parent, or husband and wife, or whoever it is as the nearest relative. Yeah, really challenging. You mentioned earlier, and I'm really interested in a bit more on the opportunities and innovations in the eating disorder service. And you mentioned early intervention. Can you tell me a bit more about why that's beneficial and how it's actually manifesting in your region?
Yeah, absolutely. So the FREED program, which is Free From Eating Disorders acronym, is the early intervention program that has been rolled out nationally, where the target is to see patients who are referred and offer them treatment within a month of presentation. And that program has now been running for, I think, 10 years. They've just had their 10-year conference, and that's been highly successful. We certainly know that the brain changes that you get from malnutrition, once the brain has been malnourished for 3 or 4 years, and we know that the behavior often becomes more chronic, and sort of the restriction and the eating disorder behaviors are harder to reverse. So it's absolutely crucial to try as hard as you can to reduce the duration of the eating disorders below that threshold. The treatment, even if you intervene early, the treatment often takes around a year, the psychological treatment of eating disorder. And it usually contains different aspects. So there could be, for example, group treatment, there will be dietetic input, there will be some support for your family of people to care for you. And there will also be some educational component to that about the physical manifestations of eating disorder, your bone health, your teeth, your skin, and those sort of things that can be affected by the eating disorder. Another component is also looking at your social functioning in recovery, and your sort of identity and how you will cope without the eating disorder in your life. Because for many patients, that's become a big part of their life, struggling with the eating disorder, fighting the eating disorder, or actually seeing the eating disorder as a sort of companion and friend, which is what I've spoken to before. But letting go of that can be really hard, and that's part of the treatment. In general, we now know from studies that treating people where they are, so at home, in the community, within their family, is much more successful than removing them to hospital and treating them as inpatients. And so that's a big part of our treatment, is to try as much as possible to avoid people having to go to psychiatric hospitals, but also to some extent to general hospitals for treatment, because we know that those who manage to recover from eating disorder at home have got much more likely to avoid a relapse later in life.
And if someone has an early sign of an eating disorder, presumably, is that reliant on primary care, say GPs, or even people working in education, like say universities, or the loved ones themselves? Are they the people who would be referring to that early service, and of course the patient themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. So the surveillance and vigilance is absolutely crucial. You know, we're doing a lot of training with GPs, but also with university staff, with school nurses, teachers. Many schools now have sort of posters up or have educated their staff about eating disorders. Obviously, eating disorders are more common in some educational settings than in others. So particular in universities where you've got, you know, young people, a large number of young people together, but also in secondary schools, and particular in places like boarding schools, you know, where young people live together. So the outreach to those sort of places and education and training is really crucial. But it's also for patients and for parents to recognize, because sometimes the initial changes can be really subtle. Someone's just a bit more withdrawn, or they're not eating lunch, or they're not snacking or going out as before. They're spending less time with friends or avoiding going to restaurants, things like that, maybe exercising more. And I think just recognizing those subtle changes and then taking action when they seem to have taken over and interfere with other normal activities that young people might be doing, that's really important. So early recognition is really important.
Yeah, and in a previous podcast, we've talked about advanced care planning. And is it fair to say, this might be a real generalization that you can shoot me down on, but is it fair to say, bearing in mind the longer you're suffering an eating disorder, you mentioned the 3 to 4 years, the brain malnourishment and how it can affect the brain directly, that a patient is more likely to have mental capacity and be able to understand and communicate everything around that eating disorder much earlier on than later in the day? And if so, do you encourage advanced care planning with people early on in that early intervention period so that they can signpost you as the future treating doctor, just in case something happens in the future when they lose capacity, as to what they would regard as their best interests?
So it's fascinating. I mean, we don't actually do that very much with young people. I have done some sort of advanced care planning with some of our older patients who are chronically underweight and who maybe don't want any further active treatment for their eating disorder, or at that time don't wish to do that, and who have specific wishes about how they would want to be treated if they deteriorate. This area is quite a difficult area of practice, because of course it all hinges on whether this person has capacity at the time when you're making the plan. And that can be really difficult to establish. So exactly as you have mentioned before, many of those patients are very intelligent and articulate. And on the surface of it, they do not seem like the sort of people where you would doubt their capacity. And of course, capacity should always be assumed. So, you know, you have capacity unless someone can show that you don't. And for them to have capacity to make decisions about their treatment, when you talk to them, it all seems very plausible. But you always have to keep in mind the psychological processes that keep the eating disorder alive, and particularly the fear of weight gain can still be really powerful, even in that chronic picture. And therefore, doing advanced care planning can be really tricky if capacity is in doubt. And doing capacity assessments on those patients can be really challenging. And in particular, the section of capacity where you have to decide whether they can weigh up objectively the risks and benefits of the treatment. And this is often the bit where you've got some doubt. On the other hand, it's really helpful for patients who live with any chronic illness, whether that's an eating disorder or another illness, to have a plan, an advanced plan, in case they deteriorate, so that they don't end up in a situation where they have treatment that they don't want. So this is a really fine line. And I think actually particularly thinking about end-of-life care. For example, if you have a severe eating disorder, which is chronic, and you have a reasonable quality of life, but you have, for example, quite bad osteoporosis, you know, would you want to be resuscitated in case your heart stops, you know, given the additional risks that would present with resuscitation, you know, in your specific case, those sorts of issues. And I think that is something where we could improve and that we could think about earlier with patients, rather than what we're doing at the moment, where, you know, we tend to do those things, you know, as they get older, rather than with younger people.
Yeah. And I know that there are, thankfully, rare, but there are some cases going through court where the judge has been asked to decide or make a decision around best interests and whether or not it's in a person's best interests to continue with active treatment or to continue with palliative treatment. And I suppose some of the issues that they have to consider when making that decision are the treatments themselves, the burdens that those treatments have on someone, having an NG tube regularly, which is very unpleasant. You mentioned osteoporosis, all other ancillary treatments, just being constantly in hospital and having no enjoyment of life, against the sanctity of life point, and often a statement made by the person who, as you say, may well not have capacity at that point, but a statement nonetheless that they want to live. And it's those cases, and as I say, they are rare, thankfully, but those cases are probably the most challenging, because the consequence of a decision might well be that the person will die. But alternatively, the consequence of continuing with active treatment might well be that their life will be very burdensome. And it's very difficult to put oneself in patients' shoes and knowing what they would want, particularly, as you say, when they perhaps don't quite understand the consequences of all the treatment and the consequences of their eating disorder. Anna, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about all of this fascinating topic today. It's astonishing just how complicated it is for you to treat some of these people, but it's also humbling to know that you're doing it, and also really encouraging that there are lots of positive news stories out there, positive treatments, the Freed Path you mentioned, which has been going for 10 years, and I know has been going very successfully, and lots of other innovations which mean that eating disorders are treatable and there is a good recovery and a good outcome for many of these people.
Stay tuned for the next episode. We'll be discussing more medical legal matters. If you haven't yet done so, please be sure to subscribe to our podcast on platforms like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to sign up to our e-newsletter to get the latest updates and content straight to your inbox. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch up in the next episode with more expert insights to help you navigate the medical legal landscape.
Thank you.